pertinent parts of the record, but not the entire record. And to that extent, we're familiar with your cases. I know you know our lighting system, and now you have a readout on your side of the lectern that gives you a readout on how much time you have left. When your time is up, please finish your sentence and stop. And I remind you that rebuttal is for rebuttal only. All right, we call the first case, U.S. versus Baker, and we hear first from Ms. Markley.
May it please the court, and good morning, counsel. The question in this case is whether the distribution enhancement of guideline 2G2.2 requires the government to prove that the defendant knew he was making material available to others. This court has not yet addressed that question, but in other cases upholding distribution enhancements, the court has found direct or circumstantial evidence of knowledge. So today, the specific requirement of knowledge is before the court for the first time. The government urges the court to adopt a rule that knowledge is not required. To resolve this case, the court must answer three questions. Whether there is a knowledge requirement, that is, whether the government must prove that the defendant knows he's making his material available to others. Whether to create a presumption of knowledge in cases involving peer-to-peer software. And whether the government can show harmlessness. On the first question, whether there is a knowledge requirement, there is a circuit split, but it's lopsided. Only the Tenth Circuit has held that there is no knowledge requirement. Six other circuits have either explicitly held or have applied the law to require that knowledge that the defendant knows the materials available to others is required. Those are the Second, Fourth, Sixth, Seventh, Eighth, and Eleventh Circuits.
We have an unpublished case that says that, don't we?
I don't believe we do, Your Honor. I believe all of the court's cases have found either direct or circumstantial knowledge.
I thought we gave the enhancement, even though, and we said it was, they didn't need proof that he was specifically aware of the capabilities of the program. In Nielsen?
In Nielsen, there was evidence that he knew because he had disabled the sharing capability at some point. Or at least he claimed he had, and the court in Nielsen found that that was a credibility contest and that the district court was entitled to disbelieve him that he wasn't actually sharing. However, the fact that he tried to disable it or claimed that he disabled it showed that he knew it was sharing. Otherwise, he could not have tried to stop it from doing so.
We've got the sentence in the comment that says that enhancement includes posting material involving the sexual exploitation of a minor on a website.
Didn't he do that?
The program did put his material in a shared folder. The question is whether he had to know that it was doing that. The comment describing distribution in that manner provides at least two clues that he had to know. One is that it has to be an act related to the transfer of the material that includes an act of posting the material. An act is defined generally understood to include an exertion of your will, a willful decision. If he didn't know it was going in there, then that is not an act. It wasn't an exercise of his will to put it in the shared folder. A second clue is that the examples provided in the list all involve purposeful contact, posting the material to a website where others can get it, possessioning it with the intent to distribute it, transporting it. Although the list, as the government argues, is not intended to be exhaustive, it is illustrative.
If you're right, then what's the difference between the five-level enhancement and the two-level enhancement? I mean, isn't the obvious difference that one requires intent and knowledge and the other doesn't?
No. The five-level enhancement is when there's bartering, when there's active trading, which...
The sharing, bartering, sharing.
Well, any sharing, just putting it out there...
I thought we were talking about five. Did you say it was two?
No, the five.
The five requires something of value coming back.
Yes.
The two, just distribute.
Yes.
That's all.
Correct. Does that answer your question, Judge Davis, or are you still...
Well, but if you when you put it on the file sharing program, it's available for someone else to get. Why isn't that distribution? I mean, it seems like the main difference in those two enhancements are the fact that you're actively knowingly sharing, and the other one is you put it out there, and there's no proof whether you shared or not, or no proof that you know that, that sharing is available.
The difference in those two is that they both require that you're knowingly putting it out there, but one requires only that. And the five-level enhancement is that you're putting it out there to get something of value back in return. And then I believe there's still another one if you're getting something for pecuniary value.
And you're saying in this case, this defendant didn't even know that it was on a website for somebody else to get.
We're saying the government didn't prove that and acknowledged that it had no evidence of that and asked the court to decide whether just having the file sharing in and of itself, government's words, would permit the inference, even if it couldn't show that he knew it was sharing or that he had a specific familiarity or general familiarity that would support that inference. In that circumstance where they can't prove it, the question really is it a per se rule?
My difficulty with your proposed rule is threefold. One is, when I look at the text of the enhancement, the operative word seemed to be any act relating to a transfer. So one would think if you take an act which is to create a peer-to-peer arrangement or file sharing, that's something relating to the transfer. So when I look at the text of the guideline, it doesn't have a scienter mens rea. It seems to have a very broad applicability anytime there is a transfer. So the text is one concern. The second is our precedent. It doesn't seem to me that we've got case law that says we're going to impute a scienter requirement. And I'm thinking of Vargas-Duran. I think you both briefed it. And the third would be, let's say we even wanted to adopt the Seventh Circuit rule or the Second Circuit rule. I don't know how that rule works. The scienter relates to what? That you know you have filed to peer-to-peer? Or that you know somebody is actually getting it off it? What does the scienter connect to? It's knowledge of what? Those are my three concerns.
The first question on the transfer, the fact that the defendant is downloading material from peer-to-peer is not sufficient because the definition specifically excludes him soliciting the material, him downloading. So the distribution has to be an act related to giving it to someone else,
sure,
transferring it to another person.
Right.
And the only act of him transferring it to another person, we would argue there is none. It's because it was in his share folder that it was available to another, and he didn't know it was there. The government hasn't proved he knew it was there. So he hasn't done an act to get it to another person.
But you say he doesn't know it's there, but that's where he's getting it from himself.
No, he's getting it from another person's computer.
No, but I thought it was the FrostWire program that he's using to look at the photos.
Yes,
and that program is one that allows you to look because it's posted in a place that other people can look too.
Yes, that other people have chosen to make available. FrostWire allows you, as I understand it, to both make things available and keep things for yourself.
And okay. And
so he knows that he can look in the ones that other people have made available. He does not know that by downloading it, he has put it in a folder that's available to others. It could be in a folder of his that's his alone.
Had he disabled the function that allowed others to obtain what he had in his file?
Excuse me, Your Honor, for interrupting. No, he had done nothing. It was just the default settings.
And if anybody wanted it, they were free to get it, as I understand it.
As it turned out, yes, because the default was to share in this particular program, but apparently that is not uniform, that the programs all operate differently. Some you can't even disable. They require sharing back and forth. Some you are default to share and you can opt out, and some default not to and you can opt in. So in this case, his happened to be the default to share, but there's no evidence, as the government acknowledged, that he knew that or that he knew he was sharing. So that's where we get this particular case.
What about Vargas-Duran? Couldn't the commission correct this pretty easily and put in the scienter standard?
Well, our position is the commission already did, that this is not a truly silent guideline or commentary, because even though the word knowingly is not in there, other evidence of a knowledge requirement is in there in the definition of the act, as well as the list of examples, which are illustrative of purposeful conduct. And when we expand a list, we still have to look at the general characteristics of the items listed and then only expand it to include things that are roughly similar. And here, where everything in the list is purposeful, to expand it from possession with intent to distribute to simple possession doesn't make any sense. If the commission had meant simple possession, it wouldn't have said possession with intent to distribute. And the other examples are similarly purposeful. Your third question was knowledge of what? And this gets into one of the main points of the government's brief, as well as, I think, the Sixth Circuit's error in Connor and its unpublished decision. Many cases refer to knowing use of peer-to-peer software when they uphold these enhancements. The government seems to believe that that means, goes to the second question here, is there a presumption? If you're using it, then you know. And proof is not required. But that is not what those courts meant when they said knowing use of peer-to-peer. Every single case, aside from Dodd, although Dodd had the evidence as well, found that the defendant actually knew his program was set to share. And then they referred to that as knowing use of the peer-to-peer software. So what they meant by that was not that he knew he was using peer-to-peer software, and so whatever the consequences of that flow to you through strict liability. What they meant was he was knowledgeable use of the peer-to-peer software. In other words, he knew he was sharing. He knew his files were set to share. That's true in all of the cases cited by the Sixth Circuit in its decision in Connor. And then the government has also filed a 28J letter with Rheingold. And Rheingold contains a string cite of six circuits that have all found actual knowledge. And it describes in those string cites and the parentheticals knowing use of peer-to-peer software. But as I said, if you look at each of those cases, when they use that word, they have found that the defendant actually knew. So for those reasons, we believe that the court should not join the Tenth Circuit, but rather should join the majority in holding that knowledge that he's making the material available to others is required. The court should hold that there is no presumption for peer-to-peer software. I note that no court has held that in a published decision. The Eighth Circuit and Dodd did not say that. In Dodd, they were very specific that they were making a fact-intensive inquiry and reviewing for clear error. It was a fact-based decision. They did include the broad language that when you use file sharing, the purpose is to share. But in Durham, the court clarified that did not create a presumption. They said it two or three times. They said they explicitly rejected the idea of a presumption. And they further said that the burden did not shift to the defendant. The Sixth Circuit's unpublished decision is the only one applying a presumption. And as I stated or implied, that court actually mischaracterizes Durham as well as every other case that it cites, unfortunately, for the idea of this presumption. So where no court is currently applying the presumption, we'd ask this court not to create one. On harmlessness, I do want to point out two important things. One is the government makes a lot of the point that defendant never raised the issue of the Section B1 two-level reduction that would also flow from the objection. In fact, he did raise that. It's on page 5 of his response to the PSR addendum. So that was properly preserved as well. The problem is that when the court considered the objections, it did not address that. It only said that if it agreed and didn't apply the two-level enhancement, it still would have imposed the 80-month sentence. And that would be working from a guideline range of 121 to 151. The government argues in its brief that's the lowest possible range here, but that's not the case. If you then subtracted the other two levels from the reduction in subsection B1, the actual guideline range would be 97 to 121 months. The court imposed a sentence of 80 months as a significant downward variance. The government cannot show that if it had started at 97 months, it would have only gone to 80 months again and would not have imposed a different sentence. It is a heavy burden for harmlessness, and the government cannot meet it here.
And Judge McBride didn't say this is a sentence I'd give even if I'm wrong about that enhancement, did he?
He said that if he did not impose the two-level enhancement, it's the sentence he would give. But as we were trying to clarify in our reply brief particularly, that's not the correct range. That's not where you would have ended up if defendant had prevailed. It wouldn't have just been not applying the two-level enhancement, in other words, a two-level swing. It would have been a four-level swing. And Judge McBride did not say anything about the four-level swing or the correct range of 97 to 121 months.
Okay, thank you very
much. Thank you.
You have some rebuttal time. Okay, Mr. McKay.
May it please the court, counsel. Brian McKay on behalf of the United States. The facts in this case are largely undisputed, and I know that the court is well aware of them. The crux of Mr. Baker's position is that his offense did not involve any act related to the transfer of child pornography because he didn't know, or more importantly, that the government didn't prove that he knew his offense involved an act related to the transfer of child pornography. But the application of the residual distribution enhancement doesn't require that the government prove such knowledge. In fact, there is no scienter requirement contained in that provision, and this court's well-established analytical framework verifies that its absence is not an oversight by the Sentencing Commission. The parties agree that the first step in this analysis is to look at the plain language of the guideline itself. And as Judge Higginson pointed out, there is no scienter requirement. If we look, we see that the residual distribution enhancement says after the sentencing court has gone through other circumstances which don't apply, but certainly as we'll discuss are relevant, but don't apply in the situation, then the question is whether the offense involves any act, and this is succinctly incorporating the definition of distribution, whether it involves any act related to the transfer of child pornography. What jumps out about that language that the commission used is its breadth in using any act. The commission certainly didn't limit it to knowing acts or intentional acts, or, as Mr. Baker contends, acts done with conscious awareness of their consequences. Instead, the Sentencing Commission said any acts, and not just acts of transfer. I noted that Ms. Markley had said, pointed out that Mr. Baker didn't do anything, an act of transferring. That's not the issue. And as the court, and I know this court, this panel in particular, is well aware from the decision in Richardson earlier this year, that is, even under the statutory definition of distribution for the offense of distribution, that doesn't work. It's not a matter of whether Mr. Baker committed an act of transfer, but whether his offense involved an act related to transferring.
But he did. He was charged with a receipt, right?
Correct.
And there's no factual basis? He just pled straight up?
He pled straight up, correct.
Okay. So I think...
I'm sorry, there's no plea agreement, but there is a factual basis for a receipt.
Okay. So as far as I understand the record, at least as it's developed, the only access somebody else had was the government accessing it, which then allowed them to discover the crime and prosecute it.
Correct.
There's a little bit of an irony here that the arguably only person that was transferred or shared with was the investigating agent who then prosecutes them.
That's correct, but I believe that's also the case in Richardson of April of this year, in which...
I guess what's the limiting principle then? Any act involving transfer, if you move away from, it would seem like putting child pornography on a computer always risks the chance that you're going to be hacked. And so it's like if you put something on your side seat and leave the door open. Arguably, that's an act relating to transfer because someone can come along and grab it. And in this case, if this is what this man did, he receives it, he looks at it himself, but we've got no proof that he ever gives it to anybody else. But the government has the capability of accessing it.
Well, not...
No?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Not just the government, but anyone.
But
there's
we don't know that anybody else did it.
We don't know that anyone else did it, okay. But whether or not there was an act of distribution is not the issue. There's a difference between leaving child pornography in the car and leaving the door open for anyone to access, or putting it in the trunk, securing it by an alarm and what have you. There's a difference between participating in a peer-to-peer file-sharing network where the expectation is I will have access to everyone else's files and they will have access to mine.
What if the government's got the sophisticated ability to enter his computer? It wasn't a peer-to-peer sharing. They just can get in. And the argument becomes, well, his act was he put it on an internet computer that people can get into.
If that was the case here, for instance, he put it in a cloud that was secured by passwords and stuff like that, and the government, through some means unavailable to other people, had hacked into, then there may be Fourth Amendment issues and stuff like that.
So your rule means most receivers of child pornography, if they keep it on their computers, will get this enhancement.
It is that most people who receive child pornography and participating in peer-to-peer file-sharing systems.
Yeah, you'll get it.
Unless they disable the sharing capabilities.
Why are the majority of circuits going the other way?
I don't think they are.
Okay.
A couple of things. First, I would point out that the 11th Circuit in Hayden, it is unpublished, but they have said there is no mens rea requirement. The 10th Circuit, as well noted, has done that. I want to caution one thing about relying too much on the Second Circuit's decision in Rheingold, and also, for that matter, the Fourth Circuit's decision in Layton, is that it runs the risk of mistaking a fact that's present in one case as a requirement that's necessary in all future cases. Yes, in those cases, there was evidence that the defendant knew, and according to that he knew that he was sharing in particular. In this court's clear line of unpublished cases, and I'm referring to Moore and Onken, Desaudier, most recently, not cited, but I think in October, the court released the unpublished decision, United States versus Marco Robles, Flores. In those cases, this court has held clearly that when someone participates in a file-sharing network, understanding that they are going to have access to other people's materials and other people will have access to theirs, that's not a two-level enhancement. That is the five-level enhancement. And as Judge Davis had pointed out, to say here, to adopt Mr. Baker's position, that he has to know to get the two-level enhancement would render as sort of nugatory that line of cases that says, no, that's the Fifth Circuit. The five-level enhancement.
Let me ask you, what kind of record did the defendant make about his level of sophistication? I mean, I know that Judge McBride made a pretty firm finding that this guy was not sophisticated enough to know about the file-sharing features of that program, didn't he?
I think that what the government conceded and what Judge McBride found was that, pointing to that line of cases that typically relies on a defendant's expertise or demonstrated skill in computers, typically the court has noted that is sufficient for a court to infer that because he was an expert or especially skilled in computers, he was aware that the nature of file sharing software is that it shares. And the government conceded in this case that we don't have evidence of that level of sophistication. For example, that he built the computer that he used, that he has specialized training or employment background in computers. We don't have that here. But so there isn't that evidence from which traditionally courts have inferred an awareness. But the government...
Did he put any evidence on about his lack of sophistication?
No. In fact, not only did he not put any evidence on that he was unsophisticated, he never even claimed it. And I think even today, both in the district court and on appeal, he's never said he didn't have that knowledge. He simply said the government didn't prove that he did have that knowledge.
And Judge McBride apparently accepted that.
He accepted that he didn't, that there wasn't the evidence, and that he could not find that he knew he was sharing with a conscious intent to get something in return and didn't apply the five-level enhancement. But I don't know that he specifically found that he was unaware. He may have implicitly made that finding, but I don't think that he says...
So your rule is any time you use file sharing software, that equals an act relating to the transfer of it.
A little bit more than that. Anytime someone uses file-sharing software, saving or downloading child pornography to their saved folder without disabling the sharing function, then yes.
Well, what was the opposing counsel tried to distinguish the Nielsen decision? I thought Nielsen was that, where the man tried to disable the software.
There is some discussion of that, but the court's analysis doesn't indicate that that's what the issue turned on. They said, then the two-level distribution enhancement applies as long as there's evidence that a torrent, or in this case an upload of child pornography, occurred from his computer. It did, and the two-level enhancement applies. As the court's noted, the Sentencing Commission understands how to apply a scienter requirement when it intends for one to apply. And I specifically point to Singleton and Surface, and we know that the commission knows how to do that and could have done that because they did that precise thing in an adjacent provision of this guideline in defining distribution to a minor as knowing distribution to a minor. And again, Singleton and Surface, this court's analysis clearly shows that is corroborative of the fact that when it didn't put scienter into the distribution, the general definition of distribution, that was an intentional decision, not just an oversight.
Let me ask you this. Is there anything in the record that shows when you download this file sharing program, are there some instructions that go with it that tell you what the benefits are and what access other people have to your file?
In this particular case, there is not that in the record. I know that in other cases, and in particular the Flores decision I referenced, in that case with the same district judge, the same AUSA, there was that evidence put forward showing that, and incidentally it was the same system, FrostWire system. There was evidence presented to the court that when someone downloads and installs this software, there are indicators that says, things like share with your friends and things like that, that would put a reasonable person on notice that what they're doing is sharing. And of course, I believe it was in Dodd, the district court in the Eighth Circuit's decision in Dodd, there might have been a time where this stuff was novel enough that someone might operate the system without understanding that they're sharing. But those times have passed, and I think that is, the Eighth Circuit has adopted that in applying the presumption that it does.
In this case, the government conceded it had no evidence to show that, as I understand it.
What the government conceded was that there was not the type of evidence that traditionally it has relied on to show that he had a special expertise. We couldn't show that he had a background in computers, employment, training, that, for instance, he built a computer. But in discussing, again, the five-level enhancement and also the government's responses to the objections of the PSR, specifically pointed out that, for example, he did download and install the software, unlike in Durham, that when interviewed about his offense, he expressed no surprise whatsoever when the agent talked about sharing, certainly supporting an inference that he expressed no surprise about that fact because he understood that was how the system worked. And finally, if we look at the precise search terms that Mr. Baker used, it's corroborative of the fact that he was well-versed enough in this underground activity that he would understand how the primary software tool that this underworld activity uses. He understood the general nature, that it was a sharing system.
What do you base that on?
I'm sorry?
What do you base that statement on? That he knew it was a sharing file.
Because, and I'm hesitant to read into the record some of the search terms that he used, but if we go to paragraph 14 of the PSR, we see terms that a novice, someone who just sat down at a computer one day, who's unaware how this underworld exists and operates, how a novice would just think of these terms. And I would draw the court's attention to the Durham decision in the Eighth Circuit. The Eighth Circuit rejected a similar argument by the government, but if we look at the search terms there, search terms like kid sex or teen sex, these are things that someone who's not steeped in that culture might very well try to, the lure, if you will, that they might cast into the water to see if they can find child pornography. But the lures that Mr. Baker used are much more precise and unlikely to simply occur to someone who decides to go out one day and catch a certain kind of pornography. Seeing that the guideline itself, the language, contains no scienter requirement, the next step is to ask whether applying it accordingly leads to absurd results, and here it certainly does not. As the court has noted, We have to keep in mind that this is not a solitary distribution enhancement. The residual distribution enhancement is just that. It's part of a five- or six-tier system. Mr. Baker wants the guideline to sort of differentiate between different levels of culpability, and that's precisely what the guideline does. It asks first, did the distribution occur in connection with, for profit or for getting something else in return other than money, or was it used as part of the grooming process? In those instances, much more culpable situations, the guideline applies a higher, between five and seven levels, a higher increase.
Why did the probation department recommend five here?
That's a very slim difference between 2 to 5 points. Very slim. You concede that, I think.
Please answer it. Yes. But there is a difference. And if we look at the interplay, just as Judge Davis had noted, if we look at the interplay between the five-level enhancement of B, distribution with expectation to receive something in return, in file-sharing cases, this court has said, where they are participating and they know they're participating in that environment, in that culture, they get the five-level enhancement. But Mr. Baker is arguing here that is the two-level enhancement. Certainly five, more than twice what two is, but also I think that to answer your question, Judge Higginson, why the probation officer did was that I think, and I don't know, it's not clearly stated, but that there is an understanding that when someone knowingly employs file-sharing software, they understand generally the nature of that system, that it is sharing, that when they are using it, they're making their files available, unless they go in and reconfigure it, that they're making their files available to others. As noted in my brief, it's also a very reasonable application to apply this residual distribution enhancement without a mens rea, because there is a reason to capture and to and when I say capture, I mean to appreciate and punish those occasions of possession or receipt that do unwittingly or negligently further the proliferation of child pornography. As noted in the Sentencing Commission's report, there are as many as an estimated 5 million unique images of abuse floating around in the internet. And there's nothing absurd or irrational about calling out those people who maybe did not intentionally distribute, or else they would have been prosecuted, and under Richardson they would have been convicted of that offense, but who nonetheless further and contribute to the damage that's done by the proliferation of child pornography. In Surface, this court said that it was not going to protect a drug dealer from the full consequences of his conduct, intentional or not. And I would submit that Mr. Baker stands in no better position than a drug dealer in this respect. When he made the conscious decision to go out and find child pornography and download it onto his computer, he, not the community, but he bore the risk that he would mishandle it. And for those reasons, we see that the language of the guideline itself, but also the structure of 2G2.2B3, they demonstrate that there is no scienter requirement implicit in the residual distribution enhancement. And for that reason, I would ask the court to affirm on that basis. Given the time, I'm not going to separately address the Eighth Circuit standards. I would rely on my brief and also the harmlessness. I certainly don't intend to waive that. I would acknowledge, as Ms. Markley had pointed out, in footnote 10 of my brief does contain a mistake, that if we assume that the court would have applied both the would not have applied the distribution enhancement and also applied the reduction, that guideline range would be 97 months to 121 months. But despite that error, the rationale of the government's the reasoning doesn't change one bit.
You received the 28J letter with the Second Circuit redecision.
I did.
You don't think that adjusts the Second Circuit case law much?
I don't think that the court should rely on that summary, unpublished summary order, for the very reason I pointed out. In relying on Rheingold, and I think that the court there did, in that summary order, did put too much stock in mistaking what was present in that case for what was required in all future cases. Okay. Thank you, and ask for affirmance.
Thank you, Mr. McKay. Okay, back to you, Ms. Markley.
Thank you. First, Your Honor, I'd like to point out that the factual resume can be found in the record at 40 to 44. However, the receipt charge was based on a file downloaded in April of 2011, and the files uploaded by the government had been on the defendant's were uploaded 4 months earlier, and then a second time of the same file 2 months earlier. So it's not the same video underlying the distribution allegation and the receipt. So the receipt charge and the factual resume does not address that issue at all.
Doesn't address the government's uploading at all. Is that your point? The factual basis doesn't relate to anyone getting it from his computer.
Right.
Okay.
It probably says that that's how it was detected. I mean, I think it's not challenged that the government uploaded the file, but it doesn't address file sharing generally, the defendant's knowledge, anything related to the arguments we're having today. I do want to address several of the government's points. One is that they've argued that the case law is not really going this way, and they point out that the 11th Circuit has held there's no mens rea. That's not what the 11th Circuit said in Hayden. The 11th Circuit said that there was not an intent requirement, but it did require knowledge. The court there held, even under the abuse of discretion standard, the district court could have reasonably concluded that Hayden knew his computer allowed other computers to receive child pornography from him. So that's Hayden from the 11th Circuit applying the knowledge requirement. Also in Rheingold's string site, there's another 11th Circuit case cited Spriggs, and that also found actual knowledge. The next point I'd like to address is the 8th Circuit. The government continues to assert that the 8th Circuit applies a presumption. But in Durham, the court addressed this twice. First, it said, we have explicitly rejected any suggestion we automatically apply a distribution enhancement based merely on a defendant's use of a file sharing program. Rather, the enhancement must be decided on a case-by-case basis depending on the facts at hand. It also said, while this court has agreed that the purposes of these programs is to share files among its users, we have consistently prohibited the automatic application of distribution enhancements based solely on a defendant's use of a file-sharing program. So those are two quotes directly from Durham showing that the Eighth Circuit does not apply a presumption. I'd also like to address the government's concessions, I guess, below, and what Judge McBride was actually asked to find. And this is a colloquy in the record at sentencing on 134. The court, well, I think you have to, in order to make the five-level increase, you would have to assume that the defendant understands the system well enough to know that if he uses file sharing, others can obtain the files he has. The government, that's correct. The court, and there's no indication here that he had that knowledge or was skilled enough to have that knowledge. The government. That is correct. We don't have evidence of that. So the government now argues that it does, but it did not ask the court to find that. It asked the court to find that it didn't have to show that. I briefly addressed that in Nielsen, knowledge was not the issue. That was a pro se appeal on plain error review of issues not raised in the district court, and it appears the defendant argued he didn't actually upload anything, that there was no distribution in fact. It was not a challenge to, and there is no discussion of a knowledge requirement in Nielsen. However, as I stated earlier, the fact that he's claiming that he disabled the software does show that he had knowledge, which is perhaps why that wasn't an issue in the case. But his argument was, I never even put it out there, I had disabled this. And the court, ruling on credibility, didn't believe him, found that he had. And so it was a question of...
Counsel are so good, they probably answered this. What does he do when he installs FrostWire? His computer has the act of installing FrostWire. What does that mean?
In many cases, and one of my, I will answer, but as a prelude, in many cases, the government puts that evidence on, and that's how they meet their burden of showing knowledge. They didn't put it on here, so we don't have a record of that. What I understand, based on what other cases have talked about other programs doing, is that you go to a website, you click a download button to download it to your software, and then you just click through a menu where it downloads onto your computer. And then once it's on your computer, you can go into the program and see the contents of other people's computers that those people have elected to make available.
You mean that all he's doing necessarily is finding a place where he can get pictures?
Yes.
He doesn't install frost wire in any way with his?
No, he does. You have to install frost wire on your computer to be able to use it.
Well, how would we construe the effect of that as an act?
My time is up. May I answer your question?
Sure, please.
Because it's not an act related to transferring to another person. The distribution definition specifically includes...
It is an act which posts a website where he and anybody can get pictures.
The definition specifically excludes soliciting the material for yourself.
I think I'm asking you to repeat yourself, so let's leave it at that. But I must say, for both counsel, you are both good lawyers, and you've made a very good presentation.
Yeah. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. All right, we have your case.